I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Aaron Sell. He is an assistant professor of psychology and criminology at Heidelberg University, and he's an expert on the evolutionary psychology of anger and aggression. Aaron, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Oh, thanks, Adam.
Thanks for taking the time. So we were just talking about some very interesting stuff about evolutionary psychology and anger before we got started. I think we could pick up off from there, but we should start by defining anger, because I'm imagining there's like a rigorous way of defining it from an evolutionary perspective when you're trying to study it.
Well, yes and no. It's more of a discovery than it is a definition, right? So, I mean, if you define the construct you're studying, you know, what if nature doesn't match up to that, right? So the way evolutionary psychologists think of the mind, we're sort of mapping out adaptations, similar as you would to the body, right? So how would you define the spleen? Well, if you're still looking for the spleen, it's not a great way to define it, right? You need to know what you're looking for. In that case, what we basically did was, for my dissertation, I kind of looked at what people call anger, right? And just look at it, find out how it works, find out what variables impact it, what triggers anger, what does anger actually do to your mind, what behaviors result from it, and then try to reverse engineer that to find out what its function is. And so from that perspective, I generally define it as it's a neurocomputational device. It's an adaptation. It's a part of the human brain, part of the human mind that functions to bargain for better treatment and functioned primarily in the ancestral past when it evolved to bargain for better treatment from other people. And that captures, I'd say maybe 95% of what people mean by anger. There, the word anger, like love, can refer to different things. So, you know, you can get angry at yourself. That's not what I'm talking about. That's more of regret. Or you can get, occasionally you can get angry or sort of determined, you know, angry at inanimate objects. Like I was in grad school. For some reason, I tried to climb a tree. I actually don't even remember why. And I got sort of frustrated by it and I couldn't do it. And then I just grabbed the tree and said, screw that, and just pulled, you know, and tore up my arm a little bit. But I got up there, right? And so people might refer to that as anger, but that's really not what I'm talking about. What I study is in a dyadic anger, mostly. You're angry at some other person because they treated you badly. And therefore, you're going to get into their head and they're going to make, you're going to change their mind. Anger is ultimately a kind of mind control device that gets into the mind of the other person and attempts to recalibrate them in ways that lead them to treat you better in the future.
Right. So we usually assume anger as this very negative thing, but obviously it evolved. So if it evolved both in humans and even in other species, or maybe in other species, it's more like aggression than anger per se, but it seems like it clearly had evolutionary benefits.
Oh yeah. Two things. Anger definitely had its precursors in other species. You can see very similar behavior patterns. So, some of the obvious ones are, particularly in the context of, aggressive anger, where you're bargaining by threatening to harm someone as opposed to bargaining by withdrawing cooperation, like the silent treatment. When you're bargaining aggressively, right, you puff your body up. I just did a study with this with undergraduate named Brandon Short. And basically, when you tell people to pose angry, they do, actually, I don't know if your listeners have video or not, but if you can see it, they kind of puff your chest up, you put your shoulders out, you lean your head up to look taller. You adopt the posture that enhances the perceptions of upper body strength, or your display of upper body strength. Like that's
pretty even
straight up animal behavior.
That.
Darwin noted that in tons of animals, right? You get aggressive, you send the maximum signal of fighting ability to your opponent to get them to back down and recalibrate. And so, yeah, the theory of anger, I call it the recalibrational theory because it's designed to recalibrate the target. That was derived basically from basic evolutionary biology of what do you do when you have a conflict with another animal? What evolves in a context where you want food and they want food? And at first glance, you might think, well, you just murder the other one and take the food. But that turns out to be a bad strategy because, you know, half the time they can kill you and they're tougher than you. Even if you win, you pay a big cost for doing that. And it turns out what actually evolves is a series of perceptual systems to try to calibrate who's going to win this fight and who. And that's partly determined by who needs the resource more. And so if you want to see how similar animals are to humans, if you look at bald eagles, when they fight over a piece of food, one of the things they do is they'll lift their neck up like this, and they'll kind of show the distension of their gullet. Like they'll essentially show, because they're very lean, right? They're birds, they have to fly, they have to be very lean. They don't have a lot of body fat on them. They show the size of their stomach to the other bird, which is a signal, which is an honest signal of this is how hungry I am. And then the other bird doesn't return, and they estimate how hungry is this other bird. Because you don't want to fight a hungry bird for food if you don't need it that badly, because they're going to fight until they die probably. and you're going to get injured, and therefore it may not be worth it, right? Uh-huh. And that is almost, that's about 65% of human anger is, I need this more than you. I don't want to go.
The smaller one, the smaller bird would actually be more intimidating.
The model that I usually, that I think was best for this circumstance, something called the asymmetric war of attrition. And it models the ratio of need, the ratio of value. In other words, how much increased reproduction do you get if you get the food versus how much I get? Mm-hmm. And that is calibrated by the ratio of formidability. How much damage can I do to you for each unit of damage you do to me? Mm-hmm. Again, measured in terms of decreased future fitness. And that formula, if you play it out, it's actually the same as the kin selection formula. It's just a discount factor on who needs something more. And if you take each variable in that formula and map it out, it goes right on to anger, which is, you need something, I need it too. So who gets it? Well, it depends on who needs it more. That's one of it. And then there's that other one, which is, how much do I care about your need? Mm-hmm. And so if I need something, then I would take it, right? Well, not if I care about you at all. And there are times where I have to care about you because you're formidable and I have to deal with you if you're willing to resist. And therefore, I have to estimate how strong you are, how tough you are, how badly you can hurt me. And that's where, you know, puffing up can get you to win arguments. Yeah. But the same things work in cooperative relationships, right? So there's, if you think about your typical case of anger, and anger is often thought of as a kind of rageful emotion, but it really isn't. Most incidents of anger are not aggressive. They don't even involve threats of aggression usually. Most incidents of anger take place between people who love each other, and they're fighting about who actually needs this thing more, right? My wife wants mm-hmm. to watch that movie. No, that movie sucks. And I want to watch this movie. And she says, no, that movie sucks. And then we argue about which movie sucks more, right? Mm-hmm. Which is relevant because it's, you know, the bird showing the stomach. It's how much do you want this versus how much I want this. And that's what I sometimes refer to as stage one anger. It's fighting over the resource, the value of the resource. That you're contesting. And that can escalate. Stage two anger is more serious. That's where you're not even arguing over the resource. You're arguing over how much you care about me. And one of the easiest ways, so I wrote this paper, it was kind of tongue in cheek. No one seemed to laugh at it, but it was a psychologist's guide to provoking violent anger. And the idea is basically, to get violent anger, you have to get out of stage one. You have to not make it about who needs this more. And you have to make it about, I know you need it. I just don't care. Uh-huh. And that's what provokes aggression and violence and withdrawal of cooperation and all these other methods that anger has of changing people's mind. So one of the fastest ways to provoke violent anger is just agree with their arguments, right? You leave your friend out in the rain. You're supposed to pick him up from the airport and you forget or something. And you show up and he's mad and he's soaking wet. And he says, you know, you left me out there for 45 minutes. Just say, yeah, I know. I'm soaking wet. Yeah, it looks really uncomfortable, you know, and that's going to provoke him, right? Because once you've accepted his perceptions of it, we both agree that you did this horrible thing to me. What you're saying to him is, our relationship is such that I should be allowed to do horrible things to you. That is how much more powerful I am than you are. And so I will do whatever I want to you, and you will accept that, right? And if you agree, well, then you've been subordinated. Sure, you'll be fine. But most likely, assuming that you're not dealing with, you know, a dictator or a president or someone or PhD advisor, someone you respect greatly and will tolerate any abuse. Assuming you're not dealing with that, then you get angry and you bargain and you say, no, I can hurt you. And that will sometimes take the form of physical aggression or bluffs of physical aggression. Anger usually starts with, you know, the anger face and the puff up. We should talk about the anger face sometime. Uh-huh. But even in cooperative relationships, then you have the same kinds of arguments, which are, you can't treat me this way, I can hurt you. But the way that you hurt people is not always physical. We think of anger as, you know, young men fighting, which it often is. But women get just as angry as men. They tend not to use physical aggression when they do it. So if my wife gets angry at me, right, she doesn't puff her chest up and threaten to hurt me. She just stops talking to me for a while. And I realize, holy shit, I need this woman and I need to make sure she's happy. Right. And so it's a fast way of recalibrating cooperative partners.
Right. So sometimes that works, whether it's ignoring, giving the silent treatment, or like getting actively angry and intimidating someone, but other times it just makes them more angry. And then you get this escalating conflict on both sides. Right. So what do you do about that?
Well, usually they fight it out, but so anger, it's reciprocal to some extent, and it works like this. According to my theory anyway, the primary trigger for anger is a recognition that another person doesn't value you highly. Mm-hmm. And so that usually comes about through them imposing some big cost on you for some small benefit. That's the ratio that indicates that they believe they are more powerful than you and that they can do what they want, right? It's the, I'm not even that hungry. You're starving. I'm going to take your food anyway, right? You can see that in nature, but only when there's one very dominant animal and one very weak animal. That's what indicates the clearest threat of anger, but it can come from lots of things, right? If someone just says you're stupid, right? That's anger provoking. Well, why? Presumably, the value we place on people is predictable by our estimation of a variety of different pillars or traits that they have. Mm-hmm. We value intelligent people. So if I think you're stupid, then I don't value you as highly, right? And therefore, you know that in my head is this kind of calibration. I call it a welfare trade-off ratio, but we probably shouldn't go into the specifics. But it's a way of looking at you and thinking, I don't have to consider your interests when I make my decisions because you're dumb or because you're weak or because, you slept with lots of men or something like that. All these insults that we have for people indicate that a person doesn't value your interests highly. And anything that indicates that can trigger anger. Now, anger itself then is also an argument. It's a way of saying, you need to treat me better. I'm not as weak as you think I am. You can't treat me like this. Mm-hmm. But that is a claim to status. It's a claim that you need to recalibrate and treat me better. Now, if you're treating me perfectly fine, right? If you, invite me on your podcast and you're all very polite and I say, hey, you didn't send me any money, right? My time is valuable. You should be spending me thousands of dollars, right? That's going to piss you off because it's a claim that I am so much above you that you have to do all these wonderful things for me. And if that's mm-hmm. not true, then what I'm doing is demanding that you subordinate yourself to me. I'm demanding that you hold me in higher regard than you deem as relevant mm-hmm. or that you deem as appropriate. And it's a very dangerous thing, right? Treating someone as much better than they actually are evolutionarily came at a cost, right? Because every time we interact, I'm going to demand that you pay for things. I'm going to demand you pick me up from the airport. I'm going to demand that you loan me money. All the things that I might demand of you are going to come at your cost or come as a cost to you because of mm-hmm. that differential relationship. And so anger is a way of saying I'm better than you think I am. You need to treat mm-hmm. me better. And that can be anger provoking itself if you treated them fine. If, uh-huh. If you consider somebody an equal and they demand to go in first, if they demand, that can provoke anger. Arrogance itself, actually, it's one of the easiest ways to provoke anger. You don't even have to target it at someone. Just walk into a room, look around and say, I am the handsomest person in this room and watch all the other men get mad at you, right?
So then narcissism would be related to anger.
Yeah, narcissism both causes and provokes anger, right? So narcissism is a correlative aggression. It's one of the narcissistic personality disorders, one of the mental disorders, I think we still call them that. Mm-hmm. That is linked to violent crime. It's often comorbid with antisocial personality disorder as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you think you're the greatest person on earth, you're going to bump into a lot of people who don't think that. And when you bump into those people, you're going to get angry because you feel entitled to extremely good treatment and they're going to treat you as average. And that's going to be anger provoking because anger is this system that says, this is how much I'm worth. Anybody who treats me like this, I get angry at.
Mm-hmm. So bring them back up
where they need to be.
There's like an evolutionary equilibrium of the amount of psychopaths in a population. Cause it's like, if there are none, you can easily take advantage of the resources that are available. But if there are too many, there won't be enough resources. So it kind of like stables out. Does that happen with either narcissism or people that are more anger prone than others?
That's a good question. There's some modeling on this. The hawk dove game is sort of built on that assumption that if you're belligerent, you can win fights easily. But if there's too many belligerent people, then the peaceful people will win out by avoiding the cost of fighting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's similar to the things I study, but mostly I study human nature, which is more or less, it's not the same exactly in everyone. There's some differences between old and young men and women, but by and large, anger works roughly the same way in all humans, right? Mm-hmm. There are calibrations, there are differences, of course. It works a little bit differently if you're weak versus if you're strong, for example. Strong people tend to be more prone to anger. Strong men in particular. The things that anger does are complex enough that they can't easily be, they can't be held in place by frequency dependent selection, which is what you're talking mm-hmm. about, where if something's rare, it goes up or down. Those sorts of things that can be stabilized that way they have to be like very close to single gene sort of mutations or things that are that maintain the levels. Yeah, it's hard to explain. So for anger to work, it has to have a lot of interlocking systems, and they all sort of have to mm-hmm. function right to produce the good outcome. So you can't have, so you can have calibrations of those systems, like being a little bit more angry, a little bit less angry, that fluctuate in the environment. And the most angry people might pay a price for that. The least angry people pay a price for that. Presumably that's true. But no, I wouldn't, my usual explanation for individual differences in anger, I would not predict that those would be highly heritable and that they were driven by low-level genes being selected because of their effects on anger at different frequencies. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know. I mean, I suppose it could be.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say that anger operates more or less the same in different people, but that people have different thresholds for moving from, let's say, stage one to stage two of anger or getting provoked?
Yeah. Yes, that is fair. And some of those differences are predictable functionally. So if you think about, you don't just inherit like an anger system and then it just stays there dormant, dumb in your head and never changing, right? Humans learn like any other species, and the learning is driven by natural selection, having designed learning mechanisms. Uh-huh. And so almost all of our adaptations learn, right? Our skin color learns, you expose it to sunlight, it'll change. Our immune systems learn, that's how vaccines work and so forth. Our bones learn, like the bow-legged thing in cowboys was real. Like if you if your legs feel stress for a certain time from having straddled a horse for 12 hours a day, your bones will learn and grow differently. And so, anger learns too. And so it wouldn't be surprising that if anger updated itself so that somebody who got angry and paid a lot of prices for that maybe became less angry, or people who got angry and it worked became more angry. I don't know if anyone's actually documented that yet, but
a while ago I spoke with a developmentalist, Richard Tremblay, who studies aggression in young children. And we talked about how his research found that by frequency, two-year-olds are like the most aggressive humans by far. It's just that they can't do much damage with their tiny little fists. And then over time they get socialized and aggression goes down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, as a father of a two-year-old, I know what he's talking about. I was very delighted that my daughter hasn't hit anyone yet. I feel like that's gone well for me. I got lucky. I mean, part of the problem is that the children don't have the, I don't know if I would call it socialized. I don't think that's the primary reason where anger goes, or where hitting behavior goes down. The problem with two-year-olds is that they really don't have any other bargaining tactics. So they have screaming and crying, which is the bargaining tactic that babies have. When they need something, they scream and cry. And that's a way of inflicting a cost on you to get you to respond. But that's more or less their only option, right? A good, smart two-year-old can't argue their way out of a problem, right? They're two. You're lucky if they're talking. And so you just don't have the same tools available for to bargain. But I mean, violence, I mean, if you study other animals too, you'll see that, you know, violence is a tool like any other that evolved by natural selection that's useful in some circumstances and can be used too much or too little. And so one of the primary differences, my first, you know, big paper actually on this was demonstrating that the calibrations, that the thresholds for anger, how angry you get in response to a given provocation, should be predictable by your bargaining power, which the same, you know, with the eagle, the bigger animal ought to demand the resource, you know, over a greater threat or over a greater number of conflicts than the smaller animal, right? Because the bigger animal can inflict costs on you and they can use that to get you to back down, right? Uh-huh. And ideally, and what normally happens, right, is you perceive that they're the bigger animal to begin with. And so you back down without even a fight. This is dominance or dominance hierarchies. Uh-huh. And so a simple prediction for that would be for young men, at least young men, are the most likely to use violence to actually get their way. Again, possibly excepting the two-year-olds, depending on what you mean by violence. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the young men using aggression with each other to get their way would suggest that young strong men should be more prone to anger than young weak men. And that was my first big study. We did this in Santa Barbara, had two samples, a couple hundred subjects, brought them to a gym, worked them out to figure out how strong they were, gave them a battery of questions measuring anger and history of aggression and so forth. And sure enough, the stronger men were more angry. And we replicated that among some hunter-gatherers in Peru, and then another group in with Ed Hagen, actually. I know you had Ed Hagen on. He and I and Nicole Hess did this one, the Aka in the Central African Republic, and showed the same thing there, that the physically stronger men were more prone to aggression, the physically weaker men were not. And interesting, it didn't work for women, which was actually a prediction, because if to the extent that women are not determining their dominance hierarchies based on physical strength, which is both intuitive and true, and Nicole has data on that as well, then being a strong woman doesn't mean you get your way, right? Uh-huh. That and so they don't resolve their differences or their conflicts in the same way. They use more subtle means of social power that are still being mapped out. And so more popular girls were more prone to anger. And attractiveness was the other big one, that physical attractiveness in women was a predictor of their anger. Mm-hmm. That physically more attractive women, among young women, I should point out, were more prone to anger than less attractive women, or women mm-hmm. who perceive themselves at least to be less attractive.
In which direction do you think it goes, whether it's for strength or attraction or popularity? Is it like the people who have better genes, let's say, are higher up in the dominance hierarchy, so they behave more aggressively because they can get away with it? Or do you think people with a predisposition for anger go out of their way to get stronger or join the right circles?
Well, I'm not sure it's better genes. It might be, but whatever, you know, access to nutrition, whatever determines how large a man grows or how strong the man gets. Whatever the source of that, the system should be built. This is my claim, that the system should be built to calibrate it to your own relative strength towards other people in your environment. So not changing you at all. If we just took every other human male on the planet and pumped them with some estrogen and made them not work out for 5 years so that you were the strongest man on the planet, then you should start spontaneously acting tougher, more entitled, more aggressive. That's the prediction mm-hmm. anyway. I mean, I can't prove that, obviously, but mm-hmm. but I mean, it would fit because we're all pretty much stronger than human beings were, 100,000 years ago or so. We've grown quite, large, having access to nutrition and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I don't think it's that angry people work out. That was a general concern of mine early on in the research, because it is a viable counter hypothesis that people who get angry a lot or have a kind of macho attitude, who get aggressive, may seek out the gym, right, and go work uh-huh. out and get stronger. And that could create this correlation. And so I ruled that out a couple of different ways. The first one was I asked them how often they went to the gym and so forth, and you can do statistical controls on that, and it mm-hmm. didn't reduce the effect. The better one, in my opinion, was showing it among the Aga and the Chimane and Native Americans, because they don't have access to gyms, right? And they're uh-huh. not known. Hunter-gatherers aren't known for working out. That's a weird Western thing where you lift heavy things for no reason.
Well, just
who the hell
getting
does
your
that?
Food is working out if you're a hunter-gatherer.
Yeah. You don't have leisure. I mean, you have leisure time, but you don't spend it sitting on a couch. They don't have couches. And so, uh-huh. I mean, they do now, but they didn't. I think at the very least makes that a very unlikely explanation. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think anyone's ever documented strength training among hunter gatherers. I'd have to double check, but.
Uh-huh. Okay. So assuming you're bigger or more dominant, on one hand, you could get away with aggression. So maybe you're more likely to be aggressive. On the other hand, if people recognize your status, you could just look at someone and they'll back down. So that would make it seem like you might need to be less aggressive if you don't need to escalate, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was an early thing I came out of my dissertation as well, that it was a concern of mine that might be the way the data came out, and I wasn't sure I'd be happy with that. The key prediction really is about anger, not aggression. It's that what you consider tolerable. And so you can get angry without being aggressive again, but what you are willing to mm-hmm. tolerate, your sense of entitlement is how we coded it, should be calibrated by that physical strength, for young men at least, and less so, if not at all, for young women. Those measures have been the most, some of the most consistent. There are big effects for the history of aggression as well, such that bigger, stronger men have a greater history of aggression. This wasn't particularly surprising. There's a bunch of old criminology data on, people in prisons are not a random sample of men, right? The men in mm-hmm. prison tend to be physically larger. That's not surprising. The idea here is that in a fairly large society, with lots of interactions between lots of different people that don't necessarily know you, you don't always have the respect that you've earned in dyadic relationships, right? Mm-hmm. In theory, does Kim Jong-un, being one of the most powerful people on the planet and certainly within his own sphere, does he have to get angry a lot, or does everyone doing everything he says every second of the day? I don't know. It's a little bit harder to predict, right? If everybody mm-hmm. is terrified of him because he's going to feed them to dogs, have them flamethrowed or whatever, he may not need to actually express anger because nothing ever uh-huh. annoys him, right? But my guess is that's probably not the case, but uh-huh. theoretically it would be possible. If you put a person the most angry person in the world in an environment where everything goes their way all the time and no one ever defies them, my theory predicts they should not get angry ever. Right? You need a trigger to actually get that anger going.
What about the idea that we kind of recalibrate our happiness threshold? So like if you win the lottery, you're ecstatic for a few weeks and then you kind of go back down the baseline. So what if the flip side happens where if you have a certain anger threshold, if everything starts going your way, the threshold just goes down until little things start bothering you more?
No, I don't think that would be, I mean, I can't rule it out. I haven't done a study on it, but it doesn't make a good evolutionary sense that the system designed to bargain for better treatment should need to fire. It's not like an immune system where you know you're going to get diseases and your immune system's hunting for them. And if you don't give them ones, then you'll get allergies or whatever because it thinks pollen must be the thing that's attacking it. It's a dangerous thing to fire your anger system, right? To demand better treatment from someone, because if you push it, again, it can be reciprocal. You getting angry at me implies you're entitled to be angry at me, which implies that I'm not treating you well enough and that it's a claim to higher status. And so you can burn through relationships with anger, can provoke aggression. There are problems with, there are costs obviously to anger. And so I think the system ought to be fairly careful about firing it. Unless you have some evidence that someone's treated you with disrespect. Now, that said, there are times where, and anger, if you think about when anger fires, you have to detect that this other person doesn't value your interests highly. And that's a kind of, it's a signal detection test. You have to find out what's in their head and you can't look because it's behind the skull and all that. So you have to judge it from their behaviors. And so you can get angry very quickly if someone does something really egregious, you know. But more commonly, what you see when you look at, you know, diary studies or just relationships generally, is that you get a lot of subtle hints, right? A lot of little things that indicate, wait a minute, I wasn't invited to that party and everybody else was, what the hell? Or, you know, somebody asks, you know, what you want for dinner and you say one thing and two other people say something else and they go with them. And you're like, wait a minute, I wanted to go somewhere else. You know, and little ones can add up and you can think of it as kind of a regression where you have a lot of different data points and you're trying to figure out in that mind what their actual welfare trade-off ratio is. How much do they actually value my interest? And so anger can sometimes be shown very, or can be triggered when you have a very clear test. So like, for example, if somebody forgets your birthday, right, that might indicate that they don't think you're a very important person, right? So lack of memory is one of the triggers of anger. Somebody forgets something about you and you're like, well, they must not like me then. They must think I'm not very important if they're forgetting my name. And so, but they might just be forgetful, right? But so there are times where you have this ambiguity, but the ambiguity is removed when another person is introduced. So for example, if somebody, your girlfriend forgets your birthday, but then she remembers her ex-boyfriend's birthday, right? That's really going to set you off because it's a very clear case. It's a, you know, it's a regression. Yeah. They're holding constant birthday memory and then they're just varying you, the other guy, right?
Yeah.
Or so somebody, eats some of your, or doesn't eat, would be an example. Doesn't loan you their car, but then you find out they loaned their car to someone else.
Right? Yeah.
Those make it very clear that it's you that they don't respect or that they don't aren't valuing your welfare.
Right.
And so those can make it some of the best triggers of anger. But other than that, you often have ambiguity. And when the ambiguity, you sometimes have people who are looking, they're suspicious. I think you don't respect me because you said that and you said that other thing. I thought you'd like that tweet and I know blah, blah. And so that can set them in a mode where they're sort of looking for the evidence, they're looking for the fight to have with you. You know, it's having a chip on your shoulder, I think is the colloquial term for that.
Yeah, so this seems like a good tie into your work on hatred, because oftentimes people don't start conflict, even if there's a repeated thing annoying them, but you kind of just slowly build up this resentment. And so, yeah, is there an evolutionary reason for that? Because you would think you would be incentivized to try and smash out any little problems right away.
Oh yeah, with infinite power, that's the best thing. The problem with hatred is, well, let's just start hatred from the beginning. So if anger is bargaining for better treatment, right? The goal of anger is to change the person's mind, right? I get angry at you and then you stop disrespecting me. This is why apologies work. Apologies are fantastic at extinguishing anger. It's the single best thing you can do when somebody's angry at you is give a heartfelt apology. It solves anger almost every time, which is really weird when you think about it. from other perspectives, because they don't give you anything. You don't have to give them anything. You just say the words, "I'm sorry, I was wrong. You were a better person than that. I shouldn't have treated you with that level of disrespect. That was my mistake, and I will not do that again." And boom, anger's gone. Right.
But if you think they're not being honest, if you think they're just saying it, that'll get you more angry. So is that
the if they're faking it, then sure. But that's rare. I mean, it'll happen if you apologize three times for the same thing. But by and large, apologies work. You know, they're reliably highly effective. And it really demonstrates the function of anger, which is to change that mind. That's what anger is trying to do. And when it does it, it shuts off, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hatred is a different thing. And I've explored it from a different selection pressure. So the thing that built anger was these conflicts of interest you have with other people and them not valuing you highly enough. Hatred, I think of as a response to a very interesting selection pressure, which is your life will get better if some other people aren't around, right? And your life will get worse if worse if other people leave, right? So love, essentially, you can think of it as the existence of this person improves my life. That's colloquially, that's how it's experienced. Evolutionarily, what it meant was over evolutionary time, the existence and well-being of some people promoted or decreased your welfare. You can just run the thought experiment. How many, you know, find a distant ancestor of yours. How many kids would they have had if, you know, Bob were removed from the planet? More, less, or the same? And if it's the same, which is for most people, then you're indifferent to them, right? But if you remove some people and their life suddenly got a lot better, that's a selection pressure. If your distant ancestor can get rid of Bob, he'll have more children, right? And so if you think about that, just not from a human perspective, as a robot perspective, just, you know, what happens if, you know, this person is removed from the planet? Does my life get better or worse? That creates this selection pressure for animals to occasionally, and the selection pressure seems to design them to just destroy this target, to heap costs upon them, hopefully until they die, but at the very least, depower them, weaken them, distance yourself from them. And if you can do that, you reproduce better. So you see this sort of thing in like siblicide in birds, right? I'll reproduce more if my brother is killed. And so the birds hatch and they kick their brothers right out of the nest and kill them, right? And so I think hatred is the result of that sort of a selection pressure, where you identify individuals in your environment whose existence is toxic for you. They exist, your life is worse. To the extent that they cannot exist, or the extent to which they have less power to do the things that are making your life worse, the better your life is. And so if that's the selection pressure, you know, what kind of mechanism would evolve? What kind of adaptation in your mind could solve that problem? Well, first, you have to identify who these people are. How do you know that a person's existence is going to be bad for you in the future? Well, the best predictor probably is that their current existence has been bad for you in the past. And so anyone whose existence is bad for you tends to get this kind of taint of dislike or hatred attached to them. And then once you've identified these people, what do you do? Well, ideally you want them gone, but that's costly because people resist being made gone. People resist, you know, murder, for example, or depowering. But what you want to do is kind of preferably in a way that prevents retaliation. So preferably quietly, without them necessarily seeing, you want to heap costs upon them any way you can, assuming that they are cost effective. So the bigger the cost to them and the cheaper it is for you to do, the better, right? You don't want to spend every waking day obsessing over them, but if there's a cheap way to hurt them badly, that's great. Take that one, right? Spread a little rumor here, recruit some allies here, you know, undercut something here, pee in a cereal, you know, whatever it is you have to do, little things that just make their life worse. And so that is really quite distinguishable from anger in terms of the aggression that it spawns, because anger aggression is loud, right? It's in your face. It's puffed up. It's how dare you treat me like that. They're threats of aggression. They're, you want them to back down and apologize. You give them the option to stop. Hatred is nothing like that. Hatred is, I want them to hurt. I want them to not be here anymore, to have keep costs heaped upon them until they are no longer. And I want them to not know that's coming. So anger, for example, has an anger face. You lower your eyebrows, you punch, you know, you do that sort of thing. You're actually puffing up the high testosterone parts of your body. You're exaggerating cues of strength in your face to make yourself seem stronger. It's the same as puffing your body up. But that gets their attention, right? Hatred is quiet. There is no hatred face. Like look at Cersei Lannister in Game of Thrones when she has her hatred face on. It's just a normal face, you know, with a certain intensity. But, and yeah, hatred is, it doesn't appear to be any higher in the strong. I still need to do some better work in this area. But the work I've done so far suggests it doesn't depend on strength, because weak people have just as much reason to hate as strong people. And it's not clear that hatred works better for one than the other, the way it does in anger.
Right. So if you're hating to take someone out whose life, who your life would be better if they were gone, what about when it's something like revenge, where the, let's say, I mean, you know, like a common movie trope, like some killer kills a family member that you love, and then you go risk everything at huge cost to yourself to kill them, even if they've like moved away and you have to hunt them down and they're not actively making your life worse aside from like the grief.
Lots of these adaptations don't work well in modern environments. And so hatred ancestrally, right? There were no people that killed your child and then went away so far away that they'll never come back. Right. And at the very least, you wouldn't know that they wouldn't come back. Right. You're small hunter gatherers. They have their feet. That's the only prime, you know, it's the only mode of transportation they have. They can't move to Detroit or something and get out of your hair. And so, a lot of these adaptations, anger, it doesn't work particularly well. The anger at strangers is very costly and useless, right? Because what's the point of recalibrating a stranger on the freeway when he cuts you off? You know, you're going to, you know, risk your life to drive up there and give him the bird. Why? You're never going to see him again. But the adaptation wasn't designed for that environment. It was designed for ancestral environments where the only way you knew it was a one-shot interaction was if you killed the person, right? If you didn't kill them, then there's a good chance they'll be back. And so a person who's willing to kill your child, for example, is an extreme danger to you, obviously, and you should risk quite a bit to make sure that they're not around anymore. On the assumption that they maybe kill your future children, for example. So that just seems to be the way the adaptation works. But it does. It is interesting that anger or that hatred seems triggered by things that really are distinguishable from anger. So, for example, you can hate people who haven't done anything bad to you. It's hard to get angry at someone who hasn't done something or indicated that they don't like you. So an example, like, you know, your wife's ex-boyfriend, right? You might think you're the greatest guy on earth even, right? But what difference does it make? You know, your life is still a little bit worse for him having been there and for your wife still kind of liking him, right? You can have, somebody flirts with you a lot and you're in a happy marriage and, you know, some young person thinks that you're really cool and they are constantly flirting with you and that's making your wife jealous, making your home life difficult. This person loves you. You can't get angry and recalibrate them on that, right? They like you. That's exactly the problem, right? But you can learn to hate them. You can learn to hate them for making your life worse. Or cases of elder abuse, I think, are very often this, where this is a person ostensibly that you love. They're your elder. They're great. They did wonderful things for you in the past, but now your life is a constant drain as you try to, you know, watching them decay slowly and forget who you are, and you have to do all their bathroom activities for them. And so people grow to hate their elders. I mean, when they're in really bad shape at the end. And so I think that may, it can explain why even if someone loves you, you can hate them if their existence is making your life worse. And that's not quite the same with anger. Anger seems designed to identify people who don't respect you. It's also why apologies don't work for hatred, right? Somebody kills your kid, says, "I'm deeply sorry. I promise I won't do it again." You know, fuck you. I don't even want to hear that, right? You killed my child. You have to die. That's, you know, I hate you. The world needs you to be gone. That seems to be the mentality.
Do you think there's a link between anger and hatred where if you hate someone, the threshold for anger gets lower? Like you'll be more likely to blow up at them for something smaller compared to someone you like?
Yeah, the interaction here is still being worked out. I had this this old study that I really found interesting. So I'll tell you what I know about this, but it's not going to be a full answer to your question. Sorry. So one of the values that predicts anger is how the value of that contested resource. Remember the two eagles fighting over the food. If the other person values it a lot more than you, then you're sort of prone to not get angry and let them have it, right? Because they need it more than you. They'll fight harder. They bargain more. I value their welfare somewhat. And so they need it more than me. So I'll let them have it. But that relationship seems to be inverted for hatred, which is where if somebody hates you and they're starving, right? And they want the food. Well, that's all the more reason not to give it to them. If they're not that hungry, fine, they can have it. What do I care if they get, you know, but if they're starving, I definitely don't want them to have it, right?
Yeah.
And so the value of that resource, the effect of that value on your emotion seems to be opposite in anger and in hatred. In anger, the more they need it, okay, fine. In hatred, the more they need it, fuck no. Like that's all the more reason to resist it. And so I think there are variables like that that sort of distinguish the two of them. Sorry, that was not your question. What was your question?
The question was if the bar for anger gets lower with someone you hate.
Oh, yeah, it's hard to know because in theory it should because your welfare trade-off ratio, the extent to which you value that person, right, is affected by hatred. If you hate them, you don't value them. In fact, hatred can be defined mathematically as a negative welfare trade-off ratio. Welfare trade-off ratio just means the ratio of interest that I would accept or that determine my behavior towards you when there's a conflict between us. So uh-huh. if I value my welfare trade-off ratio towards you as zero, it doesn't matter how hungry you are. If I want that food at all, I'm taking it. Uh-huh. If the welfare trade-off ratio is one, that's a golden rule, right? I value equal to myself. If I value at five and you value at six, it's yours. If you value at four, it's mine, right? And a negative welfare trade-off ratio is the more you value it, the less likely I am to give it to you.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the more costs I will pay to prevent you from having it. Hatred is sort of the outcome of this negative welfare trade-off ratio, that you value a person's interest negatively. Them wanting something is a reason for you not to do it. Mm-hmm. And if you just run the calculations for that, so for an incident of anger, yeah, that should have an implication. I should get mad at you for virtually anything. But it's, again, hatred, it runs separately than anger, right? So when you're angry or hate someone, you often don't display anger at them, at least. You can feel it like anger, but that's not the same thing. The adaptation of anger doesn't seem to fire most of the time. Because when you hate somebody, it's often the situation that they're a person who can't be recalibrated. Hatred's very costly. You have to take costs to impose costs on that person. Or you have to go out of your way to impose costs on that person. That can be very costly. Anger, right? Ideally, you recalibrate them and everything is fine. And so one of the reasons you would adopt hatred instead of anger is because you can't recalibrate them with anger. If you get angry at somebody and they just keep doing it no matter what you do, what recourse do you have? You can either live with the fact that they're going to constantly screw you over, or you can accept that they're not, you know, that their existence is bad for you, and then you become hateful, right?
What about something where, from an evolutionary perspective, someone's existence seems beneficial to you, but you hate them anyway? So I'm imagining a case of, let's say you have a spouse who's verbally abusive to you. They're very mean, but they give you all the kids you could want. They buy you food and they give you a place to live. So like all your basic needs are met, but you grow to hate them based off of just their behavior, which doesn't have any impact on your survival.
Yeah. So we're getting back to OJ again, which is, you know, why would you kill the mother of your children? That's a really stupid thing to do, right? In terms of, I think this is a harder problem. Martin Daly and Margaret Wilson wrote about this a lot in their homicide book, which basically the only good explanation we have for this is that it's an adaptation that's not necessarily working in its right environment, and it occasionally makes mistakes of that nature. So what you're to generalize your question a bit, you're asking, why would an animal do something that actively hinders its own reproduction? And such behavior could never be selected for, but the adaptations that give rise to it can. So, you know, the classic example would be, why would a fish ever eat a hook, right? They're just killing themselves. How does fishing ever work? Well, it works because the adaptations in the fish are for catching food, and they eat wiggly things, and you put a little worm at the end and it wiggles and there's a hook there. And so that's why they impale themselves in the hook. And so the adaptation can be, identify people whose existence is terrible for you. What cues do you use for that? Well, potentially it's the feelings of annoyance and anger, the frustrations that you experience, things you want that you can't get because of that other person, which if you're in a really bad relationship could be extremely frequent. What you eat, what you get to watch, what you do, when you get to sleep or not, whether you can think clearly, you know, whatever your complaints are in that relationship, those can add up, and that can be perceived as a very substantial cost, which at some point could trigger hatred to the point where you want that person gone from your life, even though their existence may make your life dependent on them. And so, yeah, there are certainly times where animals do things, humans included, that are not in their own reproductive interest. Of course, we're not fitness maximizers, right? We're adaptation executors. We're this machinery made of carbon and water that evolved in this past environment that on average across the species then increased the reproduction of the individuals with those adaptations, with anger and with hatred. People who are angry and hateful in the past had more kids. That's why we inherit them as emotions. But yeah, those are, you can certainly find circumstances where people do, where people make decisions that aren't, you know, in their best interests currently. I mentioned the road rage example earlier. The key question for the theory would be, if that person weren't the mother of your child and didn't make your life better in those ways, would you have hated them earlier, faster? And I'd certainly predict you would.
Yeah, that makes sense. So there's one last big topic I want to ask you about. We briefly glossed over it when you're talking about how hating a stranger in the modern day has no benefit, but in the past there were really no strangers because we lived in these small tribes. So what do you think that means for like the way we're exposed to digital media and social media, and you see these strangers, especially when it gets politicized, like you suddenly start hating people, and maybe it would make sense if you're living in a small tribe and this is your leader. Is it something like a mismatch where we're using our brains to think this is my tribal leader, even though it's like a stranger you've never met?
That's a really good question. I mean, I have the same concerns about social media that everyone does, but it's not something I've studied empirically. So take this as, you know, just one man talking on the internet. Yeah, I think one of the things that happens, and my social media is largely on Twitter and Facebook. And one of the things I've thought about is that it does make hatred cheap in a way that, I mean, anger is very difficult to get. If you look at what people are doing on Twitter, they're not angry. They're not demanding apologies. They want people ruined, right? If you look at cancel culture as an example of this, where like the apologies never work, like name someone who apologized and it didn't, and it stopped the onslaught. It doesn't. It's not about recalibrating. It's about punishing people who you think make the world worse. Uh-huh. And so that's why it has a number of features that are consistent with that. One of the bigger ones is hatred is very costly, as I mentioned, because you basically have to take on the effort of harming another person who actively resists that harm. That's very costly. But, but you know, due to the nature of there's a person out there who's making your life miserable, there's a good chance other people hate them too, right? If somebody kills your kid, the neighbors aren't going to like them. They have kids, right? The neighbors down the street aren't going to like them either. You can recruit, and you know, 50 people deciding to terminate one person, that's cheap, right? What are the odds he's going to get even one of you? And so hatred becomes more powerful when you have groups. It's one of the features of groups is that, you know, you get a group of people together and they wreck things, right? They can enact their hatred very cheaply, and that's dangerous. And so what social media does, I think, because of the way that people follow people who are similar to them, is that it's very easy to get 50 people in a Twitter thread together who all hate, you know, Patton Oswalt or Dave Chappelle or whoever's the person that you're hating at the moment. And it's very easy to get that. And once you have it, psychologically, it feels right. It feels like, yes, all of us collectively are going to get rid of this horrible person. It feels like the moral thing to do. And hatred, to some extent, can be enjoyable. People pay money to go to movies to hate people and watch them get what's coming to them, right? All the revenge movies are like that. I think that's one of the problems, is that it's an outgrowth of the polarization, so that it's a lot harder to hate somebody when you have a Twitter thread of 25 people saying, no, this guy has a point, and the other 25 people saying, no, that was really hurtful and mean, and then they have to discuss it, because then you have two groups of equal size having to negotiate. Uh-huh. But the power differentials, if you have a tremendous power differential over someone else, that makes hatred easy to employ, right? Mm-hmm. How much does Kim Jong-un have to tolerate before he has someone executed, right? He has all the power in his country. He can do whatever he wants. He doesn't like some people. They're playing some music. He executes the entire orchestra, right? They're gone now. They were on YouTube. You can't find them. That he can do that. And it's not presumably anger. They didn't disrespect him. They played their best. He just didn't like it. If you look at it that way, hatred becomes cheap when you have a huge power differential. And social media enables that power differential, or the illusion of that power differential, by allowing people who all agree to get together. Uh-huh. And then you have these kind of group polarization effects where, you know, group polarization in social psychology, your audience may not. So you take a group of people, you put in, they all have the same opinion, say they're pro-life, and you put them in a room together, and then you just wait, and they all become insanely pro-life, like extremely pro-life, because there's nobody on the other side to bring them to the middle. And they sort of make that the virtue of their group. And then you show your virtue by being more pro-life than anyone else, you know. Uh-huh. And the same thing happens if you put 10 pro-choice people in a room together. And that's just what Twitter seems to be doing, and Facebook and all the other social media. By allowing voluntary association, you get into groups with a bunch of people who agree with you. And then, you know, you become crazy and extremists. So I don't know. That's my pet theory. I have no data to back any of this up, more or less.
Yeah.
I have very little data.
If this was genuinely your tribe of small people who all agreed on a single issue, then it would make sense to side with them. But the problem is that online you can find a bubble and act like you're part of them, and then it tricks your brain into like moralizing.
And it's happening on a political level in the US that's actually quite frightening. And this there is actually good data on, that the the political polarization in the United States is it's higher than it's ever been, as far as we can tell. And so and people say it's higher than it's ever been since the Civil War. I think it's actually higher than that. Just during the Civil War, we were quite comfortable fighting wars over things we disagreed with. We were much more violent people back then, right? And so people used to go to war for relatively trivial things, right? The War of Jenkins' Ear, you know, in England, right? They cut Jenkins' ear off. We're going to war. And so anyway, so yeah, I think the polarization is probably even worse than it was in the Civil War. I can't prove it, but that's my guess. What we can prove is that if you look at political identification and its ability to predict voting outcomes, that has never been higher since it's been measured. Jonathan Haidt has research on this, but the or he displays it. I don't know if he gathered it. But yeah, you know, you can predict in the 70s, if you had a Democrat, could you predict how they'd vote? Well, sort of. But the Blue Dog Democrats tended to vote with the Republicans on economic issues. And then you had, you know, the Libertarian Republicans who would vote with the left on the social issues. And so it wasn't a great predictor. You couldn't just pick a congressman at random and know how they were going to vote. Now you can. Right? Now you know exactly how they're going to vote. You look at their party ID, and there's like one or two people maybe who are exceptions to that. And it's not just me talking. This is real data that they looked at, the extent to which you can predict a congressperson's vote from their political party. And it's never been higher than it is now. And I think that's partly just the intense polarization we're living in. And I actually don't think it's Congress's fault. I think it's probably the people's fault, because the people are polarized. And so they elect for Congress people who, you know, anyone who steps out of the party line gets punished, right?
So it relates to these in-group, out-group biases.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, was it Liz Cheney, I think, because the Republicans all hate now, and the Democrats got rid of, I forget who that guy was. It was a kind of moderate Democrat who got excommunicated. Nah, never mind. He was a vice president in one of the campaigns, but for the life of me, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, so we should probably close on something more positive. So we talked about apologies are a good way to get people to stop being angry. And then also one last thing that we talked about before we started is emotion regulation seems to play a key role in whether it's regulating anger or the behavior that comes out of anger. So like emotion regulation might be the thing that stops anger from turning into aggression, for example.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that can happen. I think the, I tend not to study, I haven't studied it as well, but certainly the hope anyway, that the promise of this theory for clinical psychology is that if people understand how the system works and they understand how it works in themselves, that they can identify the arguments that will persuade them. So the goal, I think, of much of treating patients who have anger issues, ideally what you're shooting for is not to stop the genuine conflicts, because they're genuine conflicts. They're very hard to stop. It's to try to find the ones that are based on misunderstandings.
So it's like a perspective taking thing.
Yeah. Or it's a way of your system firing, saying this person disrespects me, this person's disrespecting me. And it's trying to get that system to get some new input that says, well, maybe they just had a bad day. Maybe that person's rushing home, you know, for something important. They didn't mean to cut you off. Maybe that's a teenage driver, doesn't know what he's doing yet. It's try to introduce other arguments to the head. It's a kind of cognitive behavioral therapy to get you to consider the possibility that maybe they're not disrespecting you. Maybe they didn't actually mean it that way. Maybe they were just speaking awkwardly. Or maybe they genuinely forgot because they had something important on their mind, and it doesn't mean that they don't like you. And so if you can have those arguments ready in hand, you know, to play to your own anger system, in theory, you ought to be able to stay, you know, into stage one anger as opposed to escalate. That would be one. The other is, I mean, there are other things you can do as well, that you want to have relationships that are based on mutual cooperation more so than threats of aggression. To the extent that your bargaining systems are based on who can hurt each other more, well, then violence has to prove that you can hurt the other person more. That's what leads to aggression, a particular kind of aggression, actually. A kind of, you know, back and forth pushing and shoving aggression, as opposed to, you know, choking somebody when they're not looking, that hatred might, you know, invoke. And so ideally we want our relationship structured by cooperative value. And we actually get, you know, that's been done to a great extent. If you just look historically, right, we don't have our leaders are not war heroes anymore. They used to be, right? You know, George Washington was a general. That's why we elected him. And it's not that we shouldn't respect people who join the military and fight for their country. We should respect them. But it's not the primary way by which men in our society gain status. It's not the primary way that men become famous, by being better at hurting other people, right?
There's no more honor killings for someone who insulted you.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't brag about having dueled and killed somebody. You don't put notches on your gun. I mean, there are subcultures and gangs and such where you do, and they have all the usual problems you predict. But by and large, you become successful by what? Having an education, by earning money. Those are great things, right? Earning money means working for society. Getting an education, you know, is better for people. So for them and for others. And so, yeah, we've already done a lot of that. Like we've already kind of milked our anger system, our status system, to try to replace, you know, aggressive bargaining as a source of status with these other things. It's never complete. It's obvious, you know, teenagers, you know, the Cobra Kai show, right, still demonstrates this, right? Two people get into a fight, one of them wins, that means something. And it means that he's better than the other person. It means he's more worthy of respect than the one who loses, right? Mm-hmm. That still translates very rapidly to a normal mind, even in our culture, which is very nonviolent by, you know, historic standards, at least.
Mm-hmm. Right. That reminds me of Steve Pinker's work, Better Angels of Our Nature. So we're getting less aggressive over time, even if not less angry, right?
Oh yeah, that's not going to, presumably doesn't lower the rates of anger. I don't know. I don't know if anyone's done historical studies of that. But we just get better at managing
whatever anger we're kind of built in to have.
Yeah, well, it comes, and keep in mind, he's studying violence in general. So some of that's violence, or some of that's anger, some of that's bound to be hatred, some of it's going to be jealousy, mm-hmm. warfare, maybe its own system, probably is. And so, yeah, that's going to be a multitude of things. But a lot of the things he talked about in that, in Better Angels of Our Nature, are things that could affect anger. So, while anger is running, we talk about emotions losing control and then you can't control yourself. That's it's a metaphor. It's true to an extent, but it's obviously not true completely, right? You can get angry at somebody and want to punch them in the face and not do it because you see that some, you know, there's a police officer standing next to you, right? That has, mm-hmm. your brain is still calculating cost benefit calculations, even when you're angry. Now, I mean, it doesn't do it as well. It's not as when you're angry as when you're calm. But it'll still do that. So to the extent that we can, you know, capture people and punish them for, you know, engaging in aggression and so forth, we've lowered the crime rates using, I think that was the Leviathan was his term for that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the expanding sphere of moral worth is also useful, that there aren't, and more so over hatred, there aren't people in our society, or very few people in our society, that we identify and think, well, nobody gives a shit about them. You can hurt them and nobody cares. I think pedophiles are probably the last. Like, nobody cares if you kill a pedophile, right? That's, you can kill a pedophile and by and large, the jury will let you go. But short of that, I don't think there are any people left that just everybody doesn't care if what right. happens.
Like even moving towards abolishing the death penalty, there's something that we seem to inherently believe of, like, everyone has this, their life has value, even if they're like the worst of criminals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's the... his expanding empathy is what Pinker was talking about, where you even take the perspective of people that have treated you horribly. And yeah, I don't, that's an interesting question. Is because, I mean, hatred is clearly what's driving the need for the death penalty, is that people want that person to suffer and die. Like they, that's not enough that they're not going to hurt us. It's not enough that they're in prison where they can't, you know, do more harm. They have to die. We want them gone. Right. And so, yeah, I think that's the fact that we've been able to overcome that is rather remarkable, right? I mean, we still execute people, obviously, but, and I'm not even saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that it's remarkable that you can get human beings to think, no, even that serial killer, we shouldn't put him to death even because he's still a human being who has feelings and we should have some value in his welfare.
Yeah, that is remarkable. This was all very interesting, Aaron. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome, Adam.